Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. It's Thursday, May 24th, 2018. I am still riding the high from last night when I watched the oft deservedly made fun of Washington Capitals win a Game 7 in the Eastern Conference Finals against the Tampa Bay Lightning to make their way to the Stanley Cup Finals for the second time in franchise history. So not a lot of hockey in this podcast, I have to admit, but I wanted to talk about it, partly to gloat, partly to put it in context, and partly to talk about these Stanley Cup Finals that are coming up. And joining me to do that is first-time contributor to the show, but my former colleague at Grantland, Sean McIndoe. Sean, how are you?
I'm doing good.
Yeah, that's very promising. If you had said terrible, I would have been very upset. Let me start with this. You are a hockey expert. You're someone who's been about hockey for a long time. I am a neophyte. We're sure the Capitals have won, right? Like, they can't take it back at this point.
Yeah. No, this is it. It's done. It's final. There is no way that this could possibly go bad, other than, you know, all the dozens of horrible things that could happen in the next couple of weeks as they play in the Stanley Cup Final. But for one night at least, you're safe. That was not a dream, and you know, if anything, I think maybe you undersold it a little bit. You talk about them winning. They went in to the building of the best team in the conference, mm-hmm. and a team that had scored more goals, not just more goals than any other team in the league this year, but any team in the league in the last 8 years, and they just completely shut them down.
Right.
You know, start to finish. That was, this was no fluke, no lucky bounces. This was a start to finish. I feel like maybe saying dominating performance would be mm-hmm. overselling it a bit, but this was the better team won. I don't think there's any question about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in Game 6 as well. You know, they were more dominant in Game 6 maybe than they were in Game 7. It was strange to see them turn things on and get better when they actually needed to win. I'm not used to that feeling from the past.
This is exactly the sort of thing that Washington Capitals fans are used to seeing happen to the Washington Capitals.
Yes.
How many times do you see that where they got the other team on the ropes? Mm-hmm. And they can't finish the job, and suddenly, you know, not only can they not finish, but you're just sitting there watching them going, what happened to that team that we've been watching for the last few months? And then mm-hmm. this time it's the Tampa Bay Lightning that we're asking that question about.
Strangely the opposite. Is there a team in the NHL that is similarly cursed or has similarly awful luck in the past that you would put in the same sort of sphere as the Capitals?
You know, there are a few. Big picture, certainly my team, the Toronto Maple Leafs, move into that.
Have you written about this before?
And I've written about some of the teams, and I've written about the Sharks would be another one, the St. Louis Blues would be there, but I've written, you know, the Capitals have been the go-to team for years, and in fact, you know, 3 years ago or whatever it was, I wrote a piece for Grantland where I kind of broke down all the various ways that the Capitals had suffered heartbreaking defeat. And it's one of those posts that, even though it's a few years old, you know, still shows up time and time again. And, I mean, that was 2015. We've had two more chapters to add to the story since then. So, I feel like there's other teams in the ballpark, but I don't think there's anyone that can match, certainly the last couple of decades, maybe even more for the Washington Capitals. And if they actually go on and win this thing, mm-hmm. it's going to be kind of strange to look around and go, okay, well, who gets the crown now? Because they're going to have big shoes to fill.
All right, let's get to more about this dramatic Capitals victory, which I'm happy to talk about at great length in a moment. But first, wanted to talk about Dollar Shave Club. And granted, I'm hoping all of you out there are people who shower, people who brush their teeth. If you have hair, not all of us do. Some of us in recording this podcast do not. But if you have hair, you want to make it look presentable. If you're people who do any of those things, you don't have to do all three. But if you do even one of those things, I have good news for you, because Dollar Shave Club has stuff to help you out. And you know Dollar Shave Club has razors. You know they have stuff to help you shave. That's not in question. You know that from the name of the company itself, let alone what you've heard about it previously. But there's a lot more stuff. If you're going to do things in the bathroom, Dollar Shave Club is going to help you do those things. They deliver everything you need to look, feel, and smell your best, whether that's shampoo. Again, not really for me, but theoretically, if you have hair, shampoo, conditioner, body wash, toothpaste, hair gel. And yes, there's even a wet wipe that'll leave your tush feeling tingly clean. And if you think I wrote that, you know that's not the case. But I have to admit, it works. It's very solid. You don't want to hear me talk about it. I understand. But I promise you, it's great. I'm a big fan of their Amber and Lavender Common Body Cleanser. Nothing really smells like it out there. It is somehow manly and feminine at the same time. It feels wonderful. It smells wonderful. And you're not going to get that at your big box store. You can't go there. They don't have it. You have to go to DollarShaveClub.com. And if you do that right now, for $5, you can get their Daily Essentials Starter Set, which comes with a body cleanser, those One Wipe Charlies I alluded to earlier, the wipes for your bum, their world-famous shave butter, and their best razor, the Six-Blade Executive. If you want to be an executive, you could buy a fancy suit, or you could just get a razor and a bunch of other stuff for $5. And of course, get the blades coming for a few more bucks per month. And all that other stuff, if you want to get shampoo, toothpaste, anything else you need for the bathroom, you can get that at dollarshaveclub.com/Barnwell, which is my promo code. So again, for $5, Daily Essentials Starter Set, Body Cleanser, One Wipe Charlies, Butt Wipes, those One Wipe Charlies, Shave Butter, and the Six Blade Executive Razor. Try it now for $5, dollarshaveclub.com/Barnwell. And back to celebrating the Capitals. All right, and so obviously, it was a really fascinating game in some ways. You mentioned it was a really dominant performance from the Capitals, but we saw in the first period was an actual hockey fight, which is strange in 2018. How unlikely was the idea that there would be, in a still close game in Game 7 of the Conference Finals in 2018, there would be a legitimate fight?
Yeah, I mean, that was a surprise. And in fact, I saw a stat, Sportsnet dug it up. They said this was the first time that there was a fight in the first period of a Game 7 since the 1990 Norris Division Final. So you're going back almost three decades. Mm-hmm. And, you know, certainly, I mean, fighting has gone down in the NHL quite a bit over the last few years. But even before that, even when fighting was a big part of the game, it wasn't something that really happened in a Game 7, unless the game got out of control or out of hand, right, or something like that. And then, you know, you're sure you might want to send your message or kind of get your receipts for something that happened earlier. But to have it happen in a close game that was still up for grabs was unusual. To say the least, and you know, it sort of added to the overall entertainment value of the game and you know, the storyline. And it's one of those things where, you know, it was a weird decision by Tom Wilson of the Capitals to engage at that point, because Washington had the puck. They were potentially setting up a scoring chance, and he comes out of the penalty box and goes right into a fight. And it was the kind of thing where at the time you might say, geez, you know, was that the smartest decision? Was that, you know, is this a case of a player maybe, you know, being more concerned about settling their own scores than what's going on with the team? But the fact that the Washington Capitals won the game, and, you know, narratives being what they are, now we all point to that and say, you know, there's the turning point. There's the moment where the Capitals sent the message that they wouldn't be pushed around and all of that other stuff. It's beautiful how that works out in the hockey world.
Right. So he said after the game that he had to fight because his teammate's jersey had been pulled off. Is that on the list of official reasons why it's okay to fight?
Apparently, you know, disrespecting the jersey, I guess, is part of it. Although, you know, I think we would have probably forgiven him if he had simply kind of made a note and you can take it up next year. Because as far as the trade-off of, you know, Tom Wilson for Braden Coburn, that's a trade that the Tampa Bay Lightning will take every single time. So, you know, Tom Wilson's had a very up and down playoffs.
Yes.
You know, he's been suspended. He's been nearly suspended. He scored some big goals. He's taken some dumb penalties, and you know, now he kind of adds this to the list. He's certainly been an interesting character to watch as this whole thing has unfolded, and we'll see. He's probably got a few more things in his bag of tricks for the final.
He does. Let me ask you this, though. I'll move on. I have a lot of fight related question. Is there any real life equivalent that you can think of to sitting in opposing penalty boxes and sort of making plans to immediately fight the moment you get out of the penalty box?
You know what? It's sort of like the more immediate real-time version of like when you were kids and, you know, we're gonna fight on the playground after
yes.
school, except the playground is right in front of you and after school is, you know, literally being counted down second by second. And it's, it was clearly, something, you know, they had made the date and, I don't think anyone other than them knew. Maybe the penalty timekeepers probably knew something was gonna go on. And, even the referee didn't seem to quite realize what was going on because he skated over and kind of got in between them and almost got knocked over once he realized what was going on and he had to get out of the way.
Yes. So moving on to the finals to come, it's the Capitals and the Vegas Golden Knights, of course. And there are notable ties between these two teams, most specifically George McPhee, the former general manager of the Washington Capitals and now the executive who put together the Golden Knights. So left Washington a few years ago in a situation where it seemed like, you know, it felt like it was time for him to go. And the obvious sort of Philip that was held up was the Philip Forsberg trade, which did not go the Capitals' way in trading for Martin Erat. Do you think he gets a bad rap for what he did in Washington because of the Forsberg trade? Is that, you know, maybe a little too overstated in terms of his overall performance? And do you think what he's done in Vegas has sort of rehabilitated his reputation overnight?
Yeah, I mean, it's rehabilitated for sure. I mean, right now he's going to win the GM of the year, which is a ridiculous award the NHL where they try to reward guys who have multi-year plans for what happens in one season. He's going to win it in a walk, and he's got everybody kind of fawning over him right now, and rightly so. I mean, what he's done in Vegas is unprecedented in not just the NHL but probably the history of pro sports in general. So, you know, full credit to him. At the end of the day, look, the Philip Forsberg trade was a terrible trade. I don't think there's any defending the deal beyond the fact that you say, look, if you're, you know, you're a GM long enough, and if you're someone who's willing to make aggressive moves, sometimes you're going to have a few of them blow up in your face. And, you know, maybe that's not the worst thing in the world if the alternative is just sitting on your hands and playing it safe the way that so many GMs like to do these days. But, you know, I feel like, you know, when he was let go in Washington, the feeling was just that he had kind of built this team and taken this team as far as it could go. He had never been able to get them over the hump, had never been able to get them out of that second round in the Alexander Ovechkin era, and that it was time for a new set of eyes, maybe a new voice. And what was interesting is they go and they give the job to George McPhee's old assistant, Brian McCollum, who you know, wasn't really any of those things and hasn't really had to, you know, do a massive overhaul on this roster, and yet here they are. So, you know, yeah, this is one of those cases where if you wanted to, you could probably make a pretty good argument that George McPhee is going to be sitting up there in the press box watching a Stanley Cup final between two teams that he basically built himself.
Now, in terms of the Golden Knights, obviously they've been really impressive during the regular season, perhaps even more impressive during the postseason, really have been dominant for stretches. What's their weakness at this point? I mean, is there a thing that you think the Capitals will actually be able to exploit or at least try and exploit during these finals?
You know, it is going to be tough because the Golden Knights, as much as all of us are scratching our heads trying to figure out how the hell this happened and how you could possibly have a situation in which an expansion team comes in and isn't even trying to build a winner in year one. You know, we can go back to their public comments at the time where they were making it very clear that they expected to do a lot of losing in year one, and they had their eye on the future. And to almost, you know, by accident stumble into this Stanley Cup contender, none of it makes any sense. None of it can be explained. But yet you look at this roster, this is not some fluke team. This isn't some team that just snuck into the playoffs and happened to go on a hot streak. We've seen that happen in hockey. That hockey is a game that is very susceptible to one team getting hot, to one goalie getting hot and just carrying a team. And you know, that's not the story here. But, you know, the goaltending is, as it always is in the NHL playoffs, a big story. Marc-Andre Fleury has been fantastic. He is now going to have better than a week off, which sometimes isn't good for a goaltender because you know once you're hot, you don't necessarily want to want to sit for day after day. He's going to be a big key. At the end of the day, if he's giving them 950 goaltending again like he has throughout the playoffs, they're probably going to win. And, you know, and by the same token, Braden Holtby is throwing shutouts in, you know, game after game like he did in the last two against Tampa, then they're going to win. Mm. Beyond that, you know, the big story in Vegas is they really did build a team with a ton of speed. Mm-hmm. This is a fast team. It is a reasonably skilled team, but it's the speed and the speed with which they play. This is the conventional wisdom when it comes to NHL expansion teams is, you know, if you're going to be good, you got to be boring. You got to slow it down, clutch mm-hmm. and grab, grind it out, and just try to win 1-0 and put everyone to sleep. And they didn't do that. The Vegas Golden Knights, they went fast. They were fun. They were all, you know, all sorts of entertaining to watch. Mm-hmm. The Capitals measure up reasonably well with them. Capitals are also a fast team. They are willing to go end-to-end every now and then if they need to. But then again, we would have said the same thing about the Winnipeg Jets, and mm-hmm. they lost four straight for the first time all season once they ran into the Vegas Golden Knights.
Right. Do you think fans of long-suffering teams, not only the Capitals out, obviously, but as someone who is I believe you've written about the Maple Leafs and how it has not gone well for them for the last several decades.
I may have mentioned that once.
We don't have to get into that. That's fine. That's another topic for another day. The Maple Leafs are doing incredibly well right now. But are fans of long-suffering teams allowed to be jealous and whiny about Golden Knights fans right now?
You know what? It's funny. We just finished a long debate on my podcast on this exact topic. And, mm-hmm. you know, where I come down is if you're enjoying this Golden Knights run, go ahead and enjoy it. I'm not going to try to talk anybody out of having fun with this. It is a fun story. It's a great underdog story. There's all sorts of reasons to jump on the bandwagon and just enjoy the ride. Mm-hmm. I do get why fans of other teams, especially some of those long-suffering teams, maybe aren't enjoying this as much. And you know, some of it is just the jealousy, you know, the bitterness. You're seeing somebody else get what you want, something that you, in some cases, have waited 30, 40, 50 years for. Mm-hmm. I think that's the natural human nature. But where I think the argument is more convincing is, you know, there is a feeling, and you know, a lot of fans I've talked to are kind of watching what the Knights have done here. And, you know, yeah, it's fun and, yeah, it's crazy. But like I said, they're basically doing this by accident. And when you're a hockey fan, you're not just watching what's happening on the ice. There's a whole package that goes with it of, you know, what's going to happen at the draft? What's going to happen in the offseason? Who should we trade? How are the prospects coming along? Do we have the right coaches? All of these pieces that we worry about and think about, whether you're in Toronto with the Brendan Shanahan and his Shanna plan that's rebuilding the Leafs, whether you're in Buffalo trying to figure out how you get out of that that funk that they've been in for the last mm-hmm. few years, or you're Edmonton, or you know we could go down the list of teams in this league who are at various stages of what they had been led to believe was a multi-year plan and a multi-year strategy to get to the point where they can be champions. And when you see a team come in and quite literally build a Stanley Cup finalist, maybe a Stanley Cup winner, mm-hmm. by accident, I think it does leave a bad taste in some people's mouths, where they kind of feel like, you know, what's the point of all this? Was I really maybe, you know, kind of foolish to invest this much in that? It's kind of like, you know, the comparison I've used is, you know, when you have like your office, your office football pool, or maybe the mm-hmm. March Madness brackets, and somebody comes in who doesn't know anything about anything, and they just, you know, they're just randomly picking teams or players or whatever, and they win. And you're just kind of left sitting there looking at all your magazines and your printouts and your spreadsheets going, did I just waste my time? Do I feel mm-hmm. kind of stupid for this right now? Or, you know, maybe I shouldn't really be invested in this if just anyone can win at any time, because it feels so random. So I get that. I get why there are fans who feel that way. I'm not saying they're right or they're wrong. Mm-hmm. But I do get it, I think it's understandable on a certain level.
Do you, given that it seems like perhaps there are teams where they might be better off just dumping their entire roster, if possible, and starting anew with an expansion draft, do you think there should be a reset button where if a team pays, like, $300 million, they can get out of all their contracts and basically run through the expansion draft process themselves?
You know what? I love this idea, and I wrote about this a few months ago, and I've seen it show up recently in a bunch of other places. And I got to give credit; it was actually one of my readers sent it in as an idea. And, you know, we called it the nuclear option, where you should have the ability just scrap everything, take, you know, reset my salary cap to zero, take all the prospects, everything we've built, and let's just start over. And I think it would be fascinating if you could somehow make that option available to teams to see who would have the guts to actually take it and start over from there. You know, realistically, of course, it's not going to happen, but I do think, I just had a piece go up today on Sportsnet where I was talking about the types of conventional wisdom, the things we thought we knew mm-hmm. about how to build a team in the salary cap era, and how the Golden Knights are sort of turning a lot of that on its head. And I think one of the key pieces that people are still to some extent missing about this Vegas team is the value of the fact that they came in with a clear salary cap, no mistakes, mm-hmm. no long-term deals that they had signed and regretted, no cases where they had signed a guy who was already 30 years old to an 8-year deal, even though they knew he was probably only going to be good for the first 2 years of it. And, there's all this. We kind of just decided at some point in the NHL salary cap era that this stuff was okay. This is just what you did. It's the cost of doing business. You want somebody, hey, if they're going to be good for 3 years, you got to give them 5 years. That's just how it works. And, you're not going to get the player otherwise. And I think maybe the Golden Knights have reminded us that there is another way to do it. And, there is something to be said about keeping the balance sheet clean and showing what you can do when you're not burdened down by two or three or a half dozen bad contracts where you just kind of shrugged your shoulders and said, oh, we have to do it. Maybe you don't have to do it. And maybe some teams, who would like to have that reset button aren't going to get the reset, but you can kind of do the soft reset of looking around and saying, we're not going to do this anymore and hand out these contracts we know are going to come back and bite us.
Mm-hmm. So, something we have to do here as we wrap up, I'm going to ask you for your prediction for this series. Keep in mind, I've never cried on this show before. This may be a first-time opportunity if you do not say the thing I'm hoping you're going to say.
Well, I might make you cry.
Oh, no.
Although maybe not in the way that you expect, because I do have my pick going up. It's going up on my Vice Sports Stanley Cup preview, but I will tell you this. I have picked the Washington Capitals to win each and every series so far. Mm-hmm. I've been right 3 times. I've picked the Vegas Golden Knights to lose each and every series. I've been wrong 3 times.
Oh, no.
My prediction for this series, as far as I'm concerned, you know what? We're clearly living in the era where nothing makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing, there is no point going with the wishy-washy 7-game pick or anything like that. So I'm just, we're all in. Let's stay all in. I'm picking the Washington Capitals to win the Stanley Cup in 4 straight games over the Vegas Golden Knights.
That would be incredible. Now, let me ask you a question and wrap up here, though. Both teams touch the conference championship trophy, so how is either team going to win when they're both cursed?
Well, that is true. That is a major problem. This is the one good thing that's happened this week is maybe we could finally put that stupid superstition to death, because the whole not touching, like, it was cool for a while,
mm-hmm.
and there was kind of this neat sentiment of, no, that isn't the trophy we wanted. But then it just, like so many things in hockey, there was this kernel of kind of coolness to it, and then it just got beaten into the ground where, you had to act like you weren't even happy. You had just won a conference mm-hmm. championship. And, finally these two teams have shown us the way, I hope, unless there's some sort of wildcat player strike or Lord knows what else, and we don't, if there's an influenza outbreak.
What I was going to say.
And we lose the Stanley Cup, then we'll come back. We'll find out, like, the super virus was actually hiding in the trophy itself, and that was patient. Each of the captains was patient zero, we get the Stanley Cup.
The Prince of Wales trophy again causing another influenza outbreak. So horrible. Sean McIndoe, pleasure to have you on. Where can people check out more of your NHL coverage?
So you can find me on Sportsnet 3 times a week up here in Canada, on Vice Sports as well. Vice Sports is also the home of my podcast, the Biscuits Hockey Podcast, that I co-host with my good pal Dave Lozo. We're on once a week, including today, Thursday. Should have a new episode up later on in the day.
And you're on Twitter as well.
I am on Twitter, yeah, at Down Goes Brown. So if you would like to wait until the series is over and then tweet at me about which predictions were wrong, by all means, do that. I'd love to hear.
Well, thank you so much, Sean.
Thank you, buddy.
All right, we're going to come back and talk the NFL's kickoff conundrum with ESPN's Kevin Seifert in a moment. All right, we're going to get to our next guest, Michael Kelly, talk about the Champions League final in a moment. But I wanted to talk to you guys about SeatGeek. And after covering that Capitals Golden Knights final, I think it's fair to say if you're a fan of either of these teams, you were not really anticipating that you might want to go to a hockey game involving one of your favorite teams in late May and early June. The Knights were not expected to be very good, as I wrote about at ESPN.com. The Capitals are cursed by powers above and have no reasonable possibility of making the finals until we saw it actually happened. And if you want to get tickets for those games, which you probably don't have right now, well, you can go to our partners at SeatGeek. SeatGeek, you know SeatGeek. I know SeatGeek. They get tickets from all over the web. They use their deal score technology to rate them, so you know you're not getting ripped off. You know you're getting a good deal. And then they get them to you. You can get them on your phone. You can use your laptop. I don't think you could use an Etch-A-Sketch. I'll ask Mina Kimes when she's on the show next. I don't think that's possible, but I'm assuming you have a internet-equipped device. You can use that to get tickets for a game, whether it's the NBA, whether it's Major League Baseball, hockey, football, soccer, concerts, MMA, wrestling, anything you want tickets for, you can get them at SeatGeek. And even better than all that, right now, and honestly, in the past, probably in the future, hopefully, but right now, certainly, if you want to get tickets to anything and you haven't used SeatGeek before, you can get $20 off by using my promo code, which is Barnwell, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L. Download the SeatGeek app, go to purchase tickets, enter in that promo code, Barnwell, my last name, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L, and you'll get $20 back after your first purchase. So I don't see a reason to wait. Who knows? Maybe SeatGeek will no longer want to work with me after I espouse the virtues of the Capitals. I hope not. But SeatGeek.com or the SeatGeek app, enter in promo code Barnwell, get $20 back from your first purchase today. And joining me now to talk about the Champions League final coming up on Saturday is a regular guest on this show, a man of many websites, Michael Kelly. Mr. Kelly, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on. How you doing?
I'm great. I'm excited for this match. I feel like it's going to be, hopefully, and who knows, I feel like sometimes we get very excited about what appears to be very attacking matches and end up playing very negatively, but it seems like this matchup here in the Champions League final of Liverpool and Real Madrid, two teams that are very attack-minded and have two managers who are comfortable attacking, and Jurgen Klopp and Zinedine Zidane, it should be a fun match, right?
That's what I think. And I mean, the last four Champions League finals, which have had their drama and have had their excitement, I mean, the underdog at all four of them was either Atletico Madrid or Juventus.
Right.
These are teams that are going to defend, that are going to concede space. And Liverpool can do that, but I don't see them doing it. And even when Real Madrid concede space, there end up being tons of shots.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned in an article you wrote for The Athletic this week about Zinedine Zidane and about how, and of course we see this example with Jurgen Klopp at Liverpool, where he is a proponent of the gegenpress. He is a person who is going to press selectively up and down the pitch to try and create opportunities in, you know, with turnovers. And Zidane, whether it's, and I'm going to ask you, whether it's his personnel, whether it's just his style, it doesn't seem like that's something he's as concerned about, no?
Yeah, Real Madrid are really unusual now among top teams in that they do not press. Their rate of turning teams over is in the middle of La Liga, which is not a particularly high-pressing league to begin with. And I think to some degree it's about his personnel. I think to some degree, like, you can't run a press if you have Cristiano Ronaldo at the top of it and you're trying to preserve his legs for his shots. It's hard to run a press if you have like a true defensive midfielder with two, like, especially Toni Kroos is not a great defender. Luka Modric is still a good one, but again, you're trying to preserve his legs. He's getting older. Like, you don't force them to do as much. And then your passers are so good and your forwards are so good, they don't need transition necessarily in order to get themselves open to end up with good shots. And what it results in is a team that plays just really differently from anyone else in the world, but the lack of pressure they exert in midfield and high up the pitch is weird.
It is strange. In terms of Zidane, I mean, this is possibly one match away from him winning three consecutive Champions League finals with Real Madrid. It doesn't seem like there is the discussion around him as a truly great manager. Do you think that's unwarranted? Do you think he deserves more credit than he's gotten, perhaps, for what he does, what he's done with Madrid over the past couple of years?
Yeah, I think he deserves more credit than he's gotten. And that was one of the reasons I wrote the article, is I wanted to, like, treat him as an interesting subject for sort of, like, tactical analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he is that. Real Madrid have not been great in La Liga under his leadership. So, you know, we're really focusing on what they've done in cups. And there's a lot more randomness there. They've definitely gotten some good fortune in the cups in the last couple of years. That's not, but I think that it makes me really interested in what, the thing is that, like, he's Zinedine Zidane. Like, if he doesn't have, like, whatever broken thing, like, managers have in their heads that they just have to keep working and keep being football managers through their adult lives, he could just stop.
Right.
You know, or he could take a national team job. I think the French national team job eventually, you know, is his whenever he wants it.
Mm-hmm.
And we may never really get a chance to see him take on a bunch of different teams. You know, is this his style, or is this the way he's adapted the players he has here? Is there something he'd do somewhere else? I think there's a very good chance we'll never know the answer to that question.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in part because of that, and because people don't treat him as like a manager who's going to continue being around the game, they don't treat him as something interesting to talk about. But I think he is. It's too early to say, like, this is a great manager. But he's definitely interesting, and I would love to see what happened if he tried to have a real managerial career.
So you're saying it's the managerial equivalent of, can he do it on a wet Tuesday night in Stoke?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, Indians did not get hired by Bournemouth next year to try to keep them up. Like, it's not going to happen because he's Zidane. So, like, what does he have to prove himself on? It's
right, right. At the same time, though, he's also almost won three Champions Leagues. But we'll see. Obviously, still a lot to come there in terms of what happens in this match. And we talked about the press earlier. And I guess it seems like, you know, just in practice, you have an incredible amount of creative talent in the Madrid lineup. You figure Modric and Kroos will be the, you know, the basis of them breaking the press. I mean, are there reasons to think that they'll struggle against Liverpool's press? Or is it a situation where you think they'll do really well just because they have so much creative ability?
Yeah, and this is what I talked about at great length in my Double Pivot podcast I did with Mike Goodman. So I tried to condense that briefly. Like, I think that against Bayern Munich, they really struggled against the press. Mm-hmm. Against Bayern Munich, they were regularly getting turned over. At the same time, what they did against Bayern Munich, they ran out a pretty unusual lineup. Casemiro didn't play in the second leg, and he didn't play part of the match in the first leg as well. They were running really a two-man midfield with Modric and Kroos. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you do that, they are really in danger of getting pressed, and not just getting pressed, but getting counterattacked. Mm-hmm. Because what Casemiro does, Casemiro gets a huge number of tackles and interceptions every game. Like, his production shows up in the numbers very straightforwardly, because his job is really simple. He sits back, and when they lose possession, it's his job to clean up. And if he doesn't get to it, Ramos does. And I think that, like, if Real Madrid don't have him cleaning up, then when Liverpool press, they're going to be able to find opportunities to break.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Casemiro is really the key guy to making this work, and is a big part of the reason it didn't work against Real, against Bayern.
Mm-hmm. Where, according to your expected goal stats, Bayern Munich actually did outplay and deserved to win against Real Madrid in the semifinal.
Yeah, significantly. And I mean, if you watch the game, like, Frank Ribery and Frank Ribery was clear on goal and managed to, like, trip over the ball at one point. Lewandowski was free from, like, 7 yards out and flipped it wide. Mm-hmm. Like, these are chances. It was very clear watching the game that Bayern were creating the better chances. I think expected goals maps to something that to me, it was clear watching the match happen.
Mm-hmm. So if Casemiro's in the lineup, who would get sacrificed then?
Yeah, it's a really weird problem. Because the other thing that happened this year for Real Madrid is that Isco had a breakout season.
Mm-hmm.
They've been waiting on this. Isco is now, like, producing individual creativity numbers that are at, like, pretty close to the Messi-Neymar level.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he is an elite forward creator. But if you play him in, like, a diamond or something, because he's going to want to be central, mm-hmm. it gets a little messy. And I think that one of the problems that Real Madrid has had this year, is trying to figure out a way, because he's got these wingers, inside cutting wingers, but they are wide players in Asensio and Vasquez, who he really likes using, and they do a lot of defensive work. But their shot production is relatively, like, average.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to try to fit one of them on the pitch and Isco, suddenly you don't have any room for a big shot producer other than Ronaldo.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if they want to make trouble for Liverpool, they need to get either Benzema or Bale on the pitch. I think they need to have a second runner at that back line. Mm-hmm. You know, so that somebody is always going at Lovren.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's how you beat Liverpool. And if they do that, that's likely to be a relatively open game, because they're not going to have as much tracking back. I think Bale probably gives you the best balance mm-hmm. of tracking back defensive value and, you know, huge, like, you know, 0.8 to 1.0 expected goal per match
mm-hmm.
Attacking value. But, you know, I think that you sort of have Isco as like a fake, like a 4-3-3 with Isco as a fake wide attacker on one side
mm-hmm.
and Bale as a true wide attacker on the other side. I think that's probably how I would line it up in my head. But there's a bunch of different aspects, and I think the personnel is a huge question for Real Madrid, and it's a very they have a bunch of different approaches they can take this game, all of which are defensible in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that running out there without Casemiro is asking for trouble, though.
Mm-hmm. So you think that's the first priority, is just find a way to get Casemiro on the field and then sort of work backwards from there?
I think you've got it. I think we've seen what happens when that. As good at passing as Modric and Kroos are, that they just are not, that they're going to lose the ball sometimes against an elite press, and Bayern have one and Liverpool have one, and they need more protection mm-hmm. in those transition moments.
Makes sense. So obviously a lot of options for Real Madrid. On the other side, it seems like Liverpool's 11 are pretty much settled, no?
Yeah, unless there are injuries, it's going to be a 4-3-3 with Henderson and Milner and Wijnaldum, and the forward line is obviously mm-hmm. going to be Mane and Firmino and Salah. And one thing I've worked on this, I've got a piece coming out on this, I think at 538, is that, like, Liverpool this year have really worked on, like, being able not to press,
mm-hmm.
being able to seed space and defend deep, and then try to just spring Mo Salah against a defender. This mm-hmm. is how they beat Manchester City. I think that would probably be a bad idea in this game.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if they're inviting pressure, what they're saying is, we're going to hope that we can stop Ronaldo and Bale or Benzema running against our center backs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, like, they want to minimize how much time there is for Isco and Modric and Kroos to pick out those passes, for Ronaldo and Bale to make those runs. So I think that, you know, likely while they've improved that this year, they need to play heavy metal football to win mm-hmm. this.
It seems like they, you know, were comfortable with that in the second leg against Roma and did not play especially well, all things considered.
Yeah. Yeah, that was... I still don't have a handle on that. Apparently Klopp, after the match, said that he was mad at his players, that they hadn't had the intensity, that, like, he didn't actually intend for them to play that way, and mm-hmm. they were just too, like, dead tired from the whole season to go out and press.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one of the other questions for Liverpool, and they were good their final day of the season, but it wasn't like they playing like Brighton's B team.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't seen them play at full strength against the top team since Man City.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, I think, an open question of exactly how capable they are physically of playing their best game for 90 minutes. And that might alter Klopp's approach. It might alter the outcome. Or they might, you know, they've had 2 weeks. It's probably not time to get your legs back. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Training is weird.
I mean, Mo Salah's pretty much just been lifting awards for the last 2 weeks, it seems like, going from ceremony to ceremony, so he might be sore from that. is there still any concern about Trent Alexander-Arnold? I mean, obviously he's played really well in the Champions League, but this is a guy who's 19 still? No? He's still reasonably young, still incredibly inexperienced. Is there concern about him on the right side versus a combo of Marcelo and Cristiano Ronaldo?
Yeah, I mean, he's been very impressive this year. I think that if you want to ask questions, you can ask questions about a lot of this defensive line.
Mm-hmm.
Because Robertson has had a great year, but you know, he's 1 year removed from being a good player on Hull.
Right.
You know, and for the most part, the what he's really produced is attacking value.
Mm-hmm.
He is not great in the air if he's going to be matched up against against a big forward like mm-hmm. Bale or Ronaldo at times. Alexander Arnold has, you know, he's done well when teams have really attacked him. But there is still the possibility of mistakes. And again, he is also not that big or physical. Mm-hmm. And Dejan Lovren is, you know, he's good for getting beaten by a forward once a game against the very best teams. And, you know, they can hope that Van Dijk can clear it up. But I think that, like, minimizing the amount of time mm-hmm. that those players are defending is probably the right approach for Liverpool.
Mm-hmm. How have Liverpool adapted their attack after selling Felipe Coutinho? I mean, has it just been Mo Salah is incredible and that solved our problems? Or has there been any real sort of significant shift in how they try and attack teams?
Yeah, what's interesting, because Coutinho is one of the world's great passers.
Mm-hmm.
His numbers just blow up the passing charts every year. And what they tended to use him for was he was sort of their plan B.
Mm-hmm.
Their plan A was that they would press, win the ball. Their midfield is just, players were incredible in those transition moments, getting to that ball first, making that first quick pass. They don't have to be incredibly creative because the game is in sort of chaos around them. And mm-hmm. they just have to do a couple little things right. And then suddenly you're free, you're breaking on goals. You know, gegenpressing, counterattacking.
Right.
And if it didn't work, then they had Coutinho to try to play an incredible pass or take a long shot, which he, you know, converts more than most people do.
Mm-hmm.
And what they've done since they got rid of Coutinho is, one, double down on transition. They just play three transition midfielders no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And they get the game into moments of transition where, especially Milner, but to a lesser degree, Henderson and Wijnaldum thrive.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, exactly, they've got Mo Salah. So their plan B now is sitting back and having Mo Salah get behind a defense.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes with Firmino or Mane sort of supporting him. Mm-hmm. So now Salah is their plan B where once Coutinho was.
That makes sense. A little bit of a biased source, perhaps, but Vicente del Bosque recently said no Liverpool players would make it into Real Madrid's team. If you were being a little less biased, a little more neutral, how many players do you think actually would get into Madrid's team from Liverpool?
Yeah, so I think that one of the interesting things here is that, like, is that their strengths sort of match each other.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to think that you'd take Milner over Casemiro. It's a peculiar role that Casemiro does well, but Milner is so flexible. Milner mm-hmm. is still such a good midfielder. You'd find a way to work him in. And the other thing with Real Madrid is that both Benzema and Bale are great when they play,
mm-hmm.
but they play a relatively limited number of minutes, especially Bale.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas you're getting, you know, 3,000, 4,000 minutes out of Salah and Mane. And so, you know, if you've got one game, you know, I would take Salah over Bale or Benzema, but it's a little bit, you know, I can see how someone could imagine that they wouldn't, especially if they want to fit them into particular tactics. I still mm-hmm. wouldn't, but I see it. But over the course of a season, it's not close
right.
because of the total production that Salah gives you and you know, Mane too.
Mm-hmm. So we're finishing up here. I think you know where this is going to head. Do you have a prediction for the final? How do you think it'll go?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Liverpool have a bunch of tactical advantages. Mm-hmm. They can, I think that their press is going to give Real Madrid fits. I think we've seen Real Madrid's back line struggle more and more under pressure in ways that they haven't before. Mm-hmm. And I think that because of this, 3P is completely inevitable. It's really more of a religious question than a tactical question, and Real Madrid is going to 3P. I've been saying it's inevitable for weeks. I have not been proven wrong yet. I am sticking with it.
That makes total sense to me. Well, Michael Kaley, of course, people want more from you. Where can people check out the many places you are writing, podcasting, just getting your information out there on the internet?
Yes, as I mentioned, I snuck in there. I'm a great marketer. Great, I'm on the Double Pivot podcast. Me and Mike Goodman, also a frequent guest of the show, talking about soccer analytics every week. I've got a piece up at writing with regularly at The Athletic, where I have a piece up on Real Madrid, and I'm writing regularly at 538, where I have a piece coming up on Liverpool, so you can check those out as well.
Awesome. Well, Michael, we will monitor what happens in the bid for a three-peat, which cannot possibly be stopped, but thank you so much for coming on the show.
All right, thanks so much for having me. Have a great day.
All right, so back here on the Bill Barnwell Show, I'm still Bill Barnwell of ESPN, and joining me now to get some football discussion, we are going to talk about the NFL's new kickoff rules, and then maybe, possibly, if these rules don't work, solve the kickoff problem ourselves. Someone who's writing about the matter for several years now, I feel like, ESPN's Kevin Seifert. Kevin, how are you?
Pretty good, Bill. How are you?
I'm great. I'm excited to talk about football. Just to stick to football here, obviously that's what people clearly are discussing in the NFL these days, but I think it's probably something we should at least discuss, because it is going to impact the game and is going to impact what we see on the field, because the NFL has implemented several new rules when it comes to the kickoff. And it seems like those are motivated by, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but motivated by a desire to try and limit the possibility for concussions on kickoff plays, no?
Yes, the NFL over the past couple of years has started collecting a lot more medical data and matching it up with their actual plays. And what they found out is that on kickoffs, the concussion has been five times as likely to cause a concussion as any other play in the game. And so I think we've always known intuitively that it was a dangerous play and more dangerous probably than any other. Mm-hmm. But those numbers really jump off the page. It spoke to owners. It spoke to coaches. It has, I think, spoken to most players. Mm-hmm. And it really spurred a more dramatic effort to address it immediately than it ever has before.
So what changes has the NFL actually implemented? And is it strange that – they're not strange, but is it promising in some ways that they've made these changes in talking to special teams coaches and perhaps special teams players as well?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly beats the alternative of just how they normally do rules, which is the competition committee gets together and comes up with stuff and throws it out during the Pro Bowl or during the preseason or something, and to see how it works. They collected 9 special teams coaches, all of them very experienced and have been around for a long time. Those special teams coaches each were sort of the captain of their division and contacted all the other coaches in their division. So basically all 32 special teams coaches were consulted on this in some way, shape, or form. And it's good that it comes from them, so we know that it certainly can work in terms of not creating a whole lot of unintended consequences, and there'll be buy-in from players. It also, frankly, gives the NFL cover.
Right.
If it doesn't work, they can say, hey, you know, we consulted with the best of the best and it still didn't work, so the kickoff is eliminated, which many people in the back of their minds wonder if that's not the ultimate play here. But for the time being, what they've done is really made a bunch of changes that, if any one of them were made, would have little to no impact. And I still think, even talking to Steve Tasker, who was one of the best special teams players in history, you know, most fans might watch the kickoff this season and not notice a big difference visually. Mm-hmm. But the idea was to minimize these high velocity, high speed, high force collisions between players who are running at each other mm-hmm. from 10 and 20 yards away that caused so many of these concussions. So what they did was a couple things. One, they outlawed the two-man wedge where two right. players on the return team would basically go shoulder to shoulder. Often those guys were offensive or defensive linemen. Mm-hmm. So you have these two huge guys teaming up on one linebacker or defensive back who's sprinting down the field and bodies fly, and that is often how concussions happen. I think their data show that a third of the concussions on kickoff the past 3 years came from the wedge, and so right. that mm-hmm. that is a big thing right there.
And there they was sorry that there used that's a step down from years ago where it was possibly a three-man wedge. No,
yeah, they had three and four-man wedges, and they eliminated those, and I think a lot of people probably didn't realize that there was still allowed to be a two-man wedge, mm-hmm. but there was, and a lot of coaches would kind of stretch the legality of a two-man wedge and basically have two guys set up next to each other, and then as the play developed, a third guy might sneak over there, so you'd probably yeah. have close to in reality three-man wedge. So now none of that is possible. It's all essentially at least in that regard, I guess you could still have double teams, but for the most part, it'll be one-on-one blocking. And so mm-hmm. that is one way to get rid of the collisions. Another thing that they have done is eliminate the running start that the cover team normally has. And it was mm-hmm. only 5 yards. They could line up 5 yards behind the restraining line. But in talking to some coaches who did some experimenting with it to see how much further a guy can get in the same amount of time with that running start, it's pretty significant. So it's going to take longer for those guys to get down the field. When they do come into contact with the return team, there's probably not going to be quite the amount of speed built up as there had been. And so that's another mm-hmm. thing. A third thing they did was realign the return team to where 8 players have to be within 15 yards of the ball. Mm-hmm. And that is another way where it sort of makes it like a punt, where you have not groups of players running at each other, but players running with each other. And that, they hope, will, in essence, get the big players off the field, because you're not going to have an offensive or defensive lineman in that group of 8 who has to run back and try to block. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to have – there's only 3 other people remaining. All 3 of them who are in the back are probably going to be people who need to, reasonably be able to field the ball. So mm-hmm. neither one of the 3 in the back are probably going to be linemen. So getting those big guys off the field can also reduce the collisions. And so those are some of the things that they have worked on. The final thing that they have talked about, and this is a little bit less tangible, but they're trying to get players to come up with techniques that make them more aware of when a touchback is happening, because mm-hmm. they saw a lot of video as they were researching this of concussions happening on touchbacks. And mm-hmm. the whole focus of the NFL prior to this has been to increase the number of touchbacks, decrease the number of returns, and therefore you can reduce concussions. But they were finding that even if the play ended up being a touchback, guys were still blocking. They didn't know that was coming. Guys were still covering. They couldn't ensure that there was a touchback coming. And so there was still a lot of, full-on play going on. So mm-hmm. they're working on ways from a less tangible, more technique to have players peeking over their shoulders or somehow or other making signals to each other to know when, in fact, a touchback is coming, and they can run around blocks or pull up and hopefully address that as well. So, again, none of those individually would probably make a big difference, and it remains to be seen if collectively they do, but there is some optimism among the special teams coaches that they'll at least get at least reduce the amount of potential contact that could cause concussions.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like on a personnel level, this is going to reduce the number of offensive linemen who are on the field, possibly reduce the number of roster spots that go to offensive linemen, especially reserve linemen, and maybe the number of linemen who are active on game day on a day-to-day basis. But how do you think it's going to impact the kickoff frequency themselves? I mean, do you think we're going to see more returns perhaps than we would have in the past?
The coaches I talked to think that if anything in these rules, the kickoff team has been hamstrung. Mm-hmm. And the return team is going to be favored, not unlike we've seen over the years with defense in the passing and offense in the passing game, how the pendulum has accidentally or intentionally turned towards favoring receivers and quarterbacks over defensive pass coverage. And so that is certainly possible. You know, one of the reasons is because there's none of that, you don't get that head start as a cover team. There's going to be more space between the returner and the people who are trying to tackle him, so more room to run. You know, the idea that many teams have had in the past of kicking, or at least the past couple of years, of kicking these mortar kicks that land at like the 3-yard line and force a team to return, those might be less attractive now because there'll be a better chance for those returners who fielded at the 3 to get to the 25 or beyond, which is where the touchback would be. So then maybe that you see more deep kicks, but then on the other hand, you may probably see more returners, especially if they're good, return things from the end zone instead of taking the automatic touchback because they feel like they have a better chance to get, again, to that 25. And one other change that they made that could also impact this discussion is they are now requiring there to be essentially a balanced line for the kickoff team. So you have to have 5 guys on either side of the kicker instead of, and you can't do any of these kind of loops that you see sometimes, or twists or unbalanced lines and different things that make it more difficult for the return team to account for each guy and block them. And so now you have 5 guys on the left, 5 guys on the right. Everyone knows who they have to block. And so you probably have a better chance of blocking up a return as well. So add all those things together, and potentially you have, you know, the ideal scenario is that you have less injuries and more returns and better returns that obviously are more entertaining for the fans.
It does seem strange. Not strange, but quite the coincidence that the Patriots traded for Cordarrelle Patterson. Who
I was telling somebody that yesterday. It's funny how they're ahead on everything, isn't it?
Does seem interesting, but we'll see. Obviously, still a lot to play out when it comes to what we see from kickoffs on a week-to-week basis in the NFL.
Yeah.
But You sort of alluded to this before. It seems like even though you think these solutions might play out over the course of the year, it doesn't seem like you think there's going to be, like, that's going to solve the problem and it's the last change we're going to have with kickoffs, no?
Yeah, well, I mean, part of the issue here is nobody knows what success would look like. And just for context, from the 2016 season to 2017, concussions on kickoffs actually dropped by, like, more than 20%. That's not insignificant, you know, 20% drop, even though it fluctuates a little bit over time, but it drops 20% and still they go into this mad scramble, to try to figure out a way to fix it. So if dropping at 20% wasn't good enough to hold everybody back, how much further does it have to go before the decision makers are like, okay, yeah, we can live with that. We can live with X number of concussions or X number of injuries. I mean, so nobody knows how much further that number has to go, but they know it has to be more than 20%, obviously, because that was not anywhere close to staving off what we've already seen. And so nobody really knows what it would take and whether that eventual goal is even realistic. So there is some thought that, like, this could just be staving off the inevitable, and that we all know that in the end, that at some point in the NFL's future, whether it's 2019 or later, that the kickoff, as we know it, is more than likely to be eliminated for safety reasons, and they just weren't ready to do it yet, and they wanted to give it one or two more tries here from a football perspective before making more radical changes. So, again, I could be wrong about that, but the fact that there's not a clear goal other than making it safer is something certainly to keep an eye on.
Well, I asked you in advance. I came up with my own as well. Let's reveal our theories for how we might be able to fix the kickoff, with perhaps some of those goals in mind, whether it's entertaining, whether it's making it safer. We talked about this a little bit at the NFL Nation Summit, so I have a little bit. I think you have a little bit of idea of what I have planned, which is incredibly unlikely to happen and a very bad idea, I will say in advance. Yeah. But I want to hear what you think.
The worse, the better.
The worse, the better is right. But I want to hear what you think about, you know, if you were starting from scratch and if you had no one, you know, imposing on you what you think the kickoff should be, Kevin, what would your ideal kickoff rule be for the NFL?
Yeah, and I'm probably going to expose myself for being the complete bore that I am. but I, you know, one idea I've always liked, and in part because it brings the play more into the rest of the game. I mean, the kickoff as it stands now is very much an outlier in terms of how it plays out.
Right.
I mean, there's a football and there's guys running, but otherwise it's very much different from everything else. So I think about 5 or 6 years ago, Greg Schiano, who was the coach of at Rutgers at the time that Eric LeGrand suffered the paralyzing hit on a kickoff.
Right.
He came up. Greg Schiano obviously became sort of a kickoff, expert, and became very passionate about trying to figure out a way that sort of injury could never happen again. Mm-hmm. He came up with the idea that that I like a lot, because I think it pulls it into the kickoff into the sort of the rest of the idea of football, which is essentially after a score, it's 4th and 15, and you have the ball again. You can either punt it or you can go for it. And there's been different iterations of where you would get the ball. I think originally his idea was at the 30, because that's where kickoffs were. Now they're at the 35. Let's put it at the 40 and make it a little bit more interesting and make it truly give teams and especially as a little bit more evolution has been occurring and will continue to occur in terms of taking risks and basing things a little bit more on numbers than have been done previously in the league. Mm-hmm. Let's give them at the 40, 4th and 15. I think I looked last year, there were like 660 plays where offenses faced, 3rd and 15 or 4th and 15, and I think they got a first down on 60 some of them. So the ratio is obviously not going to be great. The risk will be somewhat high and it'll depend on where you are in the game and what you need to do. But it's also a way to keep a version of the onside kick in play, even though you're getting rid of the kickoff, which is going for it on 4th and 15. And so that keeps open the idea of a comeback, a two-score comeback late in the game, which is important to everybody. I think that does create a lot of late-game excitement and drama. And if you just got rid of the onside kick, that would really change the way people think about the end of the game or as games start coming down. So let's do that. The punt is not a safe play either. I think the data that I saw is that it's 2.5 times more likely to cause a concussion than other plays, but obviously that's a big drop from the kickoff, and there's a lot of more penalties. It's one of the most heavily penalized plays in the NFL, because when guys are running with each other, you see a lot of hand fighting. They're not colliding with each other, but they're grabbing each other, and they're not always able to get to the right side of the body, so there's a lot of pushing in the back as well, and so you see a lot of penalties, and that's no good. But overall, it feels a little bit more like a football play than a kickoff. It provides drama. It provides decision making, and it keeps open that possibility of a two-score comeback towards the end of the game. So that's my semi-boring but sneakily dramatic suggestion for where I would like to see it go if it were to go away.
Mm-hmm. I like it. I think there's a lot to that. I'm happy that yours is to try and make it more like the rest of football, because mine is almost exactly in the opposite direction. I would characterize it as something closer to like skee ball than football.
But I like skee ball.
I like skee ball too, which is why I came up with this idea. I think it's never going to happen. But my idea is entirely in the opposite direction. So it's basically just you have the kicker on the field by themselves, let's say on the 30-yard line. I think it's probably a good place to start. And there's nowhere else. It's strictly the kicker, and there's no contact on the play. It's just strictly kicking. And one of a few things can happen. So if the kicker kicks the ball through the uprights, the other team takes over, but on their 15-yard line. So there's an incentive to put the ball through the uprights. You're going to get better field position on defense. You're not going to get the ball back. It's not an onside kick, but you will get the other team in a disadvantageous situation. However, however, if you end up hitting the uprights, whether you hit the bottom of the upright, you hit the base of the uprights, you hit either side of the uprights. If you touch the uprights at all, the other team takes over on the 40-yard line. So there's some danger to possibly doing that. Now, if the kick goes through the end zone on the fly, you Gostkowski it, or you any Broncos kicker it, and it goes through the uprights. It goes, you know, not on the uprights, doesn't hit the uprights, doesn't go through the uprights, just goes through the end zone on the fly. That's going to be on the 25, so kind of what we have it as right now, a standard thing. If the kick falls short of the end zone, like it comes to a stop short of the end zone, or bounces and falls short of the end zone, or goes out of bounds, the other team takes over at midfield. So that's a, you really don't want to kick it out of bounds. That's disadvantageous. That's going to be basically the illegal procedure penalty. And the hard part for this is the onside kick. But here's what I think.
Yeah.
Here's what I think you do. And I don't think this is going to have enough onside kicks to make it worth your while, but I do think it is a possibility. So I think the pylon, the end zone pylon, is too short. That's another conversation about how to fix the fumbling into the end zone rule, which we'll talk about in a different day. But I think the pylon should be taller anyway. I think it should be two or three times its current size. So let's say you make the pylon twice its normal size. And if you kick off and you hit either pylon, you know, on a bounce, doesn't have to be on the fly, it can be on a bounce, but if you hit either pylon, that's an onside kick and you get possession on the other team's 40-yard line if you pull that off.
Interesting. So that there's a long range accuracy for kickers.
Yes.
Reward is there. Interesting.
Yeah.
It's funny how, as you talk through all that, like I know a lot of people say, "Well, wow, you know, that's crazy, just having a kicker out there." Like I was, like that part of me of it sounds great, and the part that like just having spent so much time around the competition committee, the first thing I think of is, well, that's not fair for the dome teams will have such an advantage over the teams in Chicago, Green Bay, and New England. But
that's true, yeah.
But you know, that doesn't mean you can't try, and it doesn't, you know, there's a lot more. I think if you talk to kickers, you'd find there's a lot more the kickers could do if they didn't have to worry about a returner. Mm-hmm. They didn't have to worry about like getting a ball high enough to get over a certain amount of people, that they could, it was just pure like kicking technique, and here's what I'm going to do to hit this pylon or hit the crossbar or hit the upright, that might be enough to mitigate some of the altitude / dome / weather inefficiencies there. I like it.
That's interesting. I think my idea has no chance of happening. Your idea has some sense. I think that's much more logical. But I mean, in the long run, do you think in 10 years, what do you think the chances are we actually have kickoffs in any shape or form in the NFL?
Kickoffs as we know it in 10 years, I would say a very small chance.
Wow.
You know, but I also, like, I guess it defines us how we know it. Is the Greg Schiano thing not a kickoff anymore? Is that a punt? And I think there'll be a play. I think there will always be a play between the extra point and the other team taking possession.
Mm-hmm.
But it might, I would be surprised if in 10 years it's, you know, five guys or 11 guys lining up with including a kicker kicking to 11 guys scattered around the field. Like, I think something bigger is coming than just what we've seen this year. You know, maybe it's the Greg Schiano type of thing. Maybe if they don't like your idea, they could do one of our editors, Dane Beavers, actually pointed this out to me, and I had missed it. Do you remember the scramble at the beginning?
I do, the scramble for the ball in the XFL.
I totally, like, and I actually watched the XFL, but maybe I didn't understand what was happening. And for people who didn't see it, it was basically a play where they put the ball on the ground and have one player from each team line up next to each other and just say, "Ready, set, go." And they would just run full speed at the ball, and whoever got to it first and covered it was that team got possession. And at least that was the way they started the game, at least. And so who knows? Maybe they could come up with something like that. But I think there will always be a play between the extra point and the other team taking possession. I just guess I would be surprised if it was in any way close to the kickoff as we know it now.
All right. Well, Kevin, always a pleasure to have you on. Where can people check out more of what you're thinking?
We've had a lot of stuff on the NFL page over at ESPN.com. I tend to tweet everything out at Seifert ESPN as well. So one way or the other, they can come on by.
Awesome. Kevin, thank you so much.
Okay, Bill, thank you.
All right, thanks so much for listening to today's episode of the Bill Barnwell Show. I think we're going to be grading the NFL off seasons over the next couple of weeks, so not much controversy to be had there. Everyone feels the same way about every single offseason, but we're going to have some interesting guests to talk about over the next couple of weeks. More NFL coming in the weeks to come. More Bill Barnwell Show on the way.